You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, we'll talk to America's Test Kitchen founder, Chris Kimball, about the new company he's starting, which he says will change how people cook.
First, on Monday, Senator Tammy Baldwin joined 23 other senators in a letter to the Food and Drug Administration about the current blood donation policy for men who have sex with other men. The lawmakers say the mass shooting at a gay nightclub in Orlando earlier this month emphasizes the need to allow gay and bisexual men to donate blood. They're asking for the FDA to lift the one-year abstinence from sex requirement for these men before they can donate blood.
Tammy Baldwin joins us now to talk about this issue. She's a Democratic U.S. Senator from Wisconsin. Senator Baldwin, welcome back to Central Time.
It's delightful to join you. Thank you so much for having me.
So why did you feel a need to speak out now on the issue of gay and bisexual men's blood donations?
Well, I've certainly been leading an effort for years on trying to push the FDA to base its policies on science and medicine rather than the way they've approached this before to categorically deny gay men the opportunity to provide blood donations. And I certainly was moved to speak out again on this after the horrific shooting in Orlando. We all woke up that Sunday morning to hear of 49 dead and 53 wounded, knowing that many were in hospital undergoing surgery, needing blood. And the community of Orlando came out in droves and came to blood donation centers. I saw images on TV of people lined up literally around the block to step forward as fellow compassionate citizens to do what they could, feeling helpless in other ways. One thing they could do is donate blood. And I thought to myself as I watched those images that any number of the people who were lined up to help their fellow human beings were going to be turned away because the FDA has not fully implemented changes to their lifetime ban on gay men donating blood. I've been urging them to shift to a policy that is based on individual risk factors so that any healthy American can donate blood. And, you know, the safety of our blood supply is paramount. But I feel a science-based policy is going to be much better than the outdated, unwarranted policy that exists today.
And when you say a more science-based policy, how has the science advanced since, for instance, the original ban on blood donations from men who have sex with other men during the HIV epidemic in the 80s, and then now this one-year abstinence policy? How has the science advanced in a way that you would feel comfortable lifting even that one-year deferral?
Well, first off, with all other groups of individuals who seek to donate blood, there's an assessment of their individual risk factors. There's a questionnaire that a prospective blood donor fills out, and on an individual basis, they might be turned away. But never are any other groups turned away as an entire group, regardless of the answer to individualized questions. And in most other countries, not all other countries, in the years since the AIDS epidemic first was identified, they have shifted from lifetime bans to bans of shorter duration, and then ultimately the best science dictates that using those individual surveys, we should make individual decisions about who is and who is not eligible to donate blood. I would add also that there are redundancies and safeguards in effect, and that every blood donation is also independently tested, regardless of the questionnaire that was filled out prior to donation.
And how have you made your position known to the FDA, and what specifically are you asking them to do?
Well, starting back when I was a member of the House of Representatives a number of years ago, I was able to gather some of my colleagues to ask questions about what science underpins the policy that was then in effect, and requested the FDA to convene a panel of experts to review the policy, and they review all of their blood donation policies on a periodic basis. And so, you know, take a second look at this. And I'm happy to report that indeed they did, and that there was agreement that the lifetime deferral was not scientifically or medically warranted. What they did then was move from a lifetime deferral to a year deferral, but still they treat a group of Americans differently than they treat all other individuals who would come to donate blood. And, you know, other individuals have risk factors also. I think it makes sense that we look at them individually if we are going to say to the American public that we are focused on having a completely safe blood supply, and we are also encouraging every healthy American to donate.
We're talking with U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin. And Senator Baldwin, turning to another topic that relates to the Orlando massacre, there was action in the Senate earlier this week on gun control. What was the mood like in the Senate on Monday when the four different gun bills were coming to the floor?
You know, I think at first, very hopeful. I participated in the filibuster that occurred on the Senate floor. Those are rare opportunities when an individual senator takes to the floor and holds the floor for a long period of time to raise a point. And the point that was being raised was how many times do we have to wake up to a horrific act of gun violence and see Washington fail to act. And now is the time to close the terror gap and to close the gun show loophole. In tandem, those two policies would make it less easy for potential terrorists to gain, as they did in this case, a weapon of war. I was disheartened and very sad to see the four measures fail. Actually, only two of them in my mind were really steps forward. But it was disheartening to see those fail. And I say that if all Washington can do is agree to disagree, we are lacking the leadership that the American people are demanding in the wake of these catastrophes. I am heartened, though, that another attempt, this time a bipartisan attempt, is being made with regard to the no-fly list. No-fly, no-buy is the nickname that it's been given. And I have yesterday joined my Republican colleague, Senator Susan Collins, in this effort to at least make sure that people who are on the no-fly list cannot purchase a firearm.
There are concerns that people end up on the no-fly list through no fault of their own because they have a similar or same name to someone who does belong on the list, and concerns have been voiced that once someone is on that list, even if they get taken off, that could still infringe on their gun ownership rights. How would you respond to that concern?
Well, when the no-fly list was established, there was a clear understanding that there would have to be the rights to appeal placement on that list. And so those are established, and they have been tried and tested. So with the no-fly list, you already have the due process of an appeal. And I think that that comports well with our very important Second Amendment protections, so that if somebody is wrongfully banned from buying a firearm, that they can challenge that determination through through due process. And it is important that we do that. You know, the background checks in gun stores have been the law of the land for a considerable period of time. Sometimes people get erroneously placed on the standard lists that are checked for the purchase of a long gun or a handgun, say, in the state of Wisconsin. Obviously, there's ways to appeal that also. If your name mistakenly appears on a list that would currently deny one the right to purchase a firearm.
Well, Senator Baldwin, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
I appreciate the opportunity.
That was Tammy Baldwin, Democratic U.S. Senator from Wisconsin. She joined us to talk about her recent letter to the FDA on blood donations from gay and bisexual men, as well as recent gun votes in the Senate.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, we'll talk to radio host Chris Kimball about his new initiative called Milk Street Kitchen.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
For some people, rain is the chance to hunker down indoors. For others, rain is something to enjoy outdoors. Crystal Chan grew up with a rain-loving mother who encouraged her kids not to come inside when the raindrops fell, but to go outside. She still finds herself a puddle hopper to this day.
When it starts to rain, it's common to see people stop their outdoor activities or run to the car, to a park shelter, or to the garage. Growing up in Oshkosh, I had the fortune to have a mother who would say to my brother and me, "Kids, it's raining. Want to go out?" In the beginning, she would accompany us, and we would take long walks on the wet, quiet sidewalks of our neighborhood, perhaps in the way that she did when she was a kid. Together, we would listen to the sounds of the rain hitting the upturned leaves or breaking the surface of the puddles. As we grew older, Mom didn't need to prod us. We would watch the summer clouds gather and darken, and the moment the sky would break open, my brother and I would run to put on our bathing suits, holler to Mom that we were going outside to play, and let the screen door slam behind us as we entered another world. And it was another world, a world that most grown-ups avoided, and so therefore to us was magical and free. We would make tremendous jumps in the puddles, kick up fans of water headed for the gutters, and wipe the dripping rain from our eyes. Every once in a while, a car would pass by on our quiet streets, and inevitably the driver would slow down to watch two children in bathing suits run, arms outstretched, through the cords of rain. Inevitably, we would wave to them, and they, in their dry cars, would wave back. Then the car would roll down the street, and with the moment of civility having passed, my brother and I would return to our wild, wet world once again. As an adult, the rain still calls to me. The summer downpours still evoke an urge to run outside. Now, however, I think about other things. Is the temperature too cold? Precisely how polluted is this rain? Am I going to stain my light-colored clothes? Sometimes I succumb to these adult worries, and when I do, I can feel the flame of my passion dimming, if only slightly. Other times, I succumb to my childhood longing, and when everyone else is running in, I am walking out. When I do this, I touch the memories of my youth. The sound of the screen door slamming as my brother and I come back inside, puddles gathering around our feet. The smell of Mom's warm towels waiting for us at the front door.
¶¶
Crystal Chan is a storyteller and the author of Bird. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and find us on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, the founder of America's Test Kitchen is starting a new initiative. Chris Kimball says he wants to change how people cook with Milk Street Kitchen, which will include a public television cooking show, a retail cooking school, magazines and books, and a new digital platform.
Chris Kimball joins us now to talk about this new multimedia company. He's the founder of Milk Street Kitchen and America's Test Kitchen. Chris, good to have you back on Central Time.
Thank you. It sounds really exciting. the way you described it. So.
Well, you should be the most excited. What is Milk Street Kitchen exactly?
Well, years ago, I started expanding how I cooked. You know, I grew up in New England, and it's mostly Northern European cooking. Well, you know, I started going through books from all over the world, and my brilliance, I say that parenthetically, disclosure, you know, a coming of age was that, you know, the idea of our cooking and then there's ethnic cooking is really an old-fashioned idea. Because if you live in Mexico City, you don't cook Mexican food, you cook dinner, right? I mean, everybody all over the world, you know, has to put dinner on the table, right? So it's just all cooking. And if you look at the fashion and music industry, they've done this years ago. You know, they beg, borrow, and steal things from all over the world and create new stuff. So as I started cooking out of these books and talking to people like Fuchsia Dunlop, who wrote Every Grain of Rice about Sichuan cooking, well, it turns out there's a whole bunch of things the way she cooks that actually is better than the way I cook, you know, with simpler, bigger flavors. You know, throw a chicken in simmering water for 25 minutes, turn off the heat, let it sit half an hour, it's done. And you make a quick sauce with some soy sauce and some ginger, et cetera. And, you know, what an easy way to put dinner on the table. So I just thought there's all this stuff we don't know. And if you look all over the world and take out the simple stuff and put it together, you know, you'd have a better way to put dinner on the table even on Tuesday night.
Do you think we throw up barriers in our own heads about cooking when we think about cuisines that may not be our own or techniques we may not know and think, I can't do that? But really, is there a common sort of lingua franca for cooking? If you know how to do certain things, you can cook anything.
Well, that's a great question. And I was just cooking with Claire Patak. She wrote the Violet Bakery cookbook. She used to be the pastry chef for Alice Waters. She had the place in London. And I was watching her make this flourless chocolate cake. And she was whipping egg whites, and she was about half done. She said, I'm done. And I said, Claire, you're not done. It's not the soft peak. She said, here's the rule. You know, whip egg whites the same texture, the batter you're folding them into. Hmm. And I went, you know, the big light bulb went off. And I said, yeah. Of course, that makes sense. So it turns out this stuff is just a half a step away from the familiar. It's not weird. It's not strange ingredients. It's stuff that is just a little bit, you know, just a little bit ahead of where we are. But boy, you see people do it and you go, that's great. So the mistake we've all made, I've certainly made it, that I somehow think, you know, recipes or techniques from other places are different, weird, you know, not for me. But boy, take chicken soup. You know, you can make an American chicken soup. I've made it 100 times. It's fine. But places in the world, like in Ukraine, you know, they'll throw huge handfuls of herbs in it, or they'll use ginger and scallions in China, or they might use chipotle peppers and tortilla strips in Mexico, or spices. There's just a million ways to take that recipe and with just 2 minutes of work, change it totally. So it's really exciting because it's bigger flavors. You know, French cooking is about technique, right? It's about, you know, unless you have better technique, you can't make better food. But if you look around the world, it's not about technique so much. It's just about how you think about cooking.
Chris Kimball is the founder of Milk Street Kitchen and America's Test Kitchen. And Chris, before we go any further, I have to ask, where did the name Milk Street Kitchen come from?
Well, it came from two places. It came from my wife, who absolutely insisted that had to be the name, and she was right. And two, our new kitchen's on Milk Street.
So, well, there you go.
We're on 177 Milk Street in Boston, being constructed now. It'll be ready in September. So I've always wanted a kitchen that was really home to the whole enterprise. And when I used to do the Cook's Country show, I actually had a house in the town that I in Vermont, my town, where I fixed it up, and we shot the show there. And I've always felt that it would be really important to have a place people could come to, they could take a tour, they could watch us do the TV show, whatever. And so Milk Street is the actual location.
Now, you've said that Milk Street Kitchen, this whole project, has really reinvigorated your love of cooking. How has it done that? I mean, you love cooking already. What did it do for you?
I found that I had to relearn how to cook. And I'm still in that process. I will always be in that process. And my cooking got so much better, you know, because the way you think about putting foods together in a Northern European sense is great, but it's really about heat. You know, you take meat, you take wheat, you take vegetables and dairy, and it's the process of heating them up, like in a stew, where you create flavor. Well, yeah, that works, but there are lots of other ways to create flavor. You know, the Ottoman Empire had 88 spices. Northern Europe had 12. French cooking has about 4 or 5 herbs it uses. It uses almost no spices at all. Some people think because French wine doesn't actually taste very good with spicy food. It's one theory. But there are all these tools you have at your disposal, and when you open up your mind to that, without doing anything strange or hard-to-find ingredients, you can actually make much better food with the same amount of effort. And so all of a sudden, you know, in half an hour or whatever, I could do something just really amazing, much better than what I used to turn out. I mean, let me give you a simple example. Scrambled eggs. You know, about a year ago, I started using olive oil instead of butter. And I noticed that the eggs came out totally differently. And I did a little homework, and I was reading a Bass cookbook a month ago, and the recipe was 2 eggs, 1 tablespoon olive oil. You know, it's nothing new. But the olive oil gets much hotter than butter. Butter has water in it. So you get more steam and fluffier eggs. So that's just a great example of a 3-ingredient recipe where just switching from butter to olive oil makes a huge difference, you know.
Chris, it looks like exciting things coming out of Milk Kitchen. Thank you so much for joining us and telling us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Chris Kimball, founder of America's Test Kitchen. He joined us to talk about his new company. It's called Milk Street Kitchen. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight at 7, it's Snap Judgment. In tonight's episode, you may have the wisdom of the ages, but when life throws you a curveball, even you may need some help. That's tonight at 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, retirement can mean very different things to different people, but most of us look forward to a life after work that allows time to pursue hobbies, travel, spend time with family and friends, or maybe even work at a job that's just not about the money.
Financial service provider TIAA has been surveying their retirement plan participants for over 30 years to gauge attitudes and expectations about retirement. They just released a new edition of their Voices of Experience survey.
Joining us to discuss those new findings is Kathy McCabe. She's a senior managing director at TIAA. Kathy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So how did the Voices of Experience survey first start? Why did TIAA decide this was a priority?
Well, we wanted to get a sense, and this goes, you know, back to 1982, on, you know, how those that retired were doing. So we asked a series of questions and then thought it was a great idea to check in and see, you know, over 30 years later, what are the attitudes of those who did retire? Were they enjoying their retirement years? And despite current headlines focusing on retirement anxiety, many of TIAA retirees have a very positive reality.
And so you specifically directed the survey to TIAA retirement investors. Who does that include? Because you do have a kind of a specific audience.
Yeah, this most recent survey that was done just in 2016 was for over 1,600 retirement plan participants. And remember, we are in the nonprofit sector. So we were founded by Andrew Carnegie nearly 100 years ago to help ensure that teachers could retire with dignity. But we offer our plans now to millions of participants in the nonprofit, including academia, research, medical, government, and cultural fields. So it is a very specific snapshot of a particular group of people.
But on the other hand, within that very specific group, it could be anyone from, say, a maintenance worker in a hospital up to the CEO of that same hospital or of an educational institution.
That is absolutely correct, because remember, we are serving all employees at these institutions. So your examples were spot on, from janitorial staff to administrative staff to faculty, and in the healthcare arena, doctors and nurses. So yeah, it really runs the gamut.
So the first survey was in the 1980s. Is this the first time that it's been updated?
Yes, I believe this is the first one since 1982. So the results that we had in 2016 were being compared to those in 1982. And when you look at the statistics, it's interesting that there's a lot more consistency than differences over 30 years later with the results.
So overall, Kathy, are the people that you surveyed satisfied with retirement?
Yes, that's overall very satisfied. I'll give you a couple of very specific stats. Today, 93% of the TIA retiree survey said they're satisfied with retirement, and this is virtually unchanged from the 1982 survey, where 92% were satisfied. And actually, the intensity of satisfaction has increased, with 65% of respondents saying that they're very satisfied, up from 51% back in 1982. And they're saying, it's what a comment you kind of said, which is they're reporting that it's just as fun and exciting as their professional careers were.
Well, and we'll talk a little later about how they're spending all that free time that they have. I found that a really interesting part. I did find it intriguing that the satisfaction with retirement, the rating did vary a little bit depending on what age people were when they retired. What were the differences there? They weren't huge, but what differences did you see?
Yeah, they weren't huge. It's typically more than half of those surveyed, about 54%, retire before age 65. This is up from 39% back in 1982. Today's retirees, 71% said they expected to work until 65, but only 47% did. And they're more optimistic. Much of that, we think, is because they're retiring by choice. 77% said they were cautiously optimistic or looking forward to retirement, and 76% they retire by choice, which is up from 67% in 1982.
So people that retired not by choice may have been, say, laid off or their hours were reduced, and instead of trying to find a whole new job, it just made more sense for them to retire at that point.
That could be the case.
So one of the findings that was interesting was that people are tending to retire earlier. 54% of those surveys retired before age 65. And as you said, that's up from just 39% in 1982. But what I found really interesting is people are living longer. And so that means being retired for more years than previous generations. What are the implications of that, that people are living longer, so retirement's longer anyway, and then they're retiring even younger?
Right. Well, one of the things, you know, some key things, and this really applies to not just those that were surveyed by TIA, but really all people, it's the early planning, right? So starting as early as you can. The survey showed that people that started to plan for their retirement before age 30, 75% indicated that they were very satisfied in retirement. But good news is that, and this is kind of unexpected, that those who started planning after age 50 were 60% were also said that they were very satisfied. So it's a good message to those to say that it's not too late, but again, the earlier you plan, the better off you're going to be. And you're right. So people are not only living longer, but they're retiring earlier. And I think something that's really important is understanding that you don't just want to accumulate a big nest egg, but you really want to understand how to distribute that nest egg and help ensure that it lasts for your lifetime. And that's where, you know, having that guaranteed lifetime income stream through an annuity, at least for a foundation to help meet your fixed expenses, is really important. And 1%, you know, one other statistic that really stood out is that 57% said they did not have to change their financial picture. They stuck with what they started with, and they were very satisfied.
Kathy McCabe is a senior managing director at TIAA. That financial service provider has been surveying the retirement plan participants for over 30 years to look at attitudes about retirement. And we're talking about the newest edition of their Voices of Experience survey. And as you just mentioned, Kathy, of course, a big part of retirement is being able to support yourself without that weekly or monthly paycheck coming in. And so it sounds like people are doing well, but is it all based on what they were able to save for retirement? I'm guessing that people who are retired currently are also taking Social Security, and that may or may not be an option for people who are a few decades younger than them right now.
Right. Yes. I mean, those that have retired, many, it's, you know, they have both their retirement income, what they save personally, and Social Security to, you know, help them meet their needs. And, you know, we don't know the future, but I think one of the things that we've hit home for years, and I've been doing this for 29 years at TIAA, is the earlier you start and start socking away as much as you possibly can, knowing there are going to be things that happen throughout your career, you know, different life events that you might have to shift for, like college education and getting married and buying a home. But really, the minute you start to work, start saving. One of the things in our industry, in the 403B industry, oftentimes the retirement plans are mandatory. And oftentimes the contribution rates are higher than, the 401k industry. So on average, between employees and the employer, it could be upwards to about 14%. So it's a very robust plan. But, my message to all, whether you're in our world or in America at large, and no matter your age, is try to save as much as you possibly can and as early as you can.
I think one of the most interesting aspects of the survey was asking people how active they are in retirement. And I had a laugh because it seems like the feeling that people have of being more busy after they stop working actually might be true from your results. How many activities are people saying that they're involved with in retirement?
You're right. That was a really interesting statistic. Those surveyed that were the most satisfied are engaged in 10 or more activities. 76% report that they're very satisfied. Those that are engaged in 1 to 4 activities, only about 52% report the same. So the more they're involved in, the happier they are. One of the things we also found from the survey, and this is very consistent from 1982, is that they're not working for compensation. So they're really in retirement. And that was another comment you made, that maybe you'll do a little work where you're not required to have a paycheck, but you want to do something. 80% of today's retirees are not working for compensation, and they do have the freedom to spend time doing the charitable activities or providing care for family or the hobbies that they're interested in. And that's very similar to 1982, where the survey said that 79% were not working for pay. So they really were doing the activities that they had always wanted to do, and they're really doing them.
And Kathy, what kinds of activities are people taking part in? Did you find people doing more social activities, or are a lot of them more solitary things, like maybe gardening or reading?
Yeah, it's a mixture, with the highest one being the pursuit of personal interests. So the solitary, as you said, at 75%. Another large percent, though, was connecting and spending time with family at 74%. Socializing with friends on a regular basis was 64%. And traveling in retirement came in at about 51%. So it's lots of different things and, just really taking advantage of that time that they have.
We're talking with Kathy McCabe about the most recent Voices of Experience survey that the financial service provider TIAA conducted to gauge attitudes towards retirement.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you're already retired, is it what you expected? How are you spending your time? And what advice would you offer others who are hoping to join you in the ranks of the retired at some point? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page, where you can also find a link to the TIAA survey results.
We'll pick up this conversation and welcome your calls in just a moment here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're continuing our conversation now about attitudes towards retirement, how people spend their time after they stop working officially, and what concerns, if any, that they have.
And we hope you'll join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. Are you actively planning for your retirement? Do you hope to stop working completely, or do you plan to taper off? What worries do you have about retirement? And do you and your spouse agree on what the goals of retirement are? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. Just search for Central Time on WPR. Well, I just kind of touched on this, Kathy, but I think, you know, we do hear that there's often an adjustment period for spouses when one or both of them retires and suddenly they're together more, or maybe they have different ideas of what retirement's supposed to be about. Is that something that you touched on in the survey?
That wasn't something that was touched on, so I'm not really able to speculate, although I do have my thoughts on that.
Well, I did see that 95% said their relationship was as good or better than before retirement, so I think maybe we can read into that transition was easier than they thought.
Yeah, and I think many times, this is just an important part is including your spouse or partner in the planning process, whether you both worked or one worked and the other didn't. One thing that we have found is that, being a part of the process all along the way, again, it's not just about starting to save early, but the whole planning process really makes a difference. And the earlier you start planning, the more satisfied people are. And when you include your partner in that process, it's a much better transition.
Of course, even the best planned for and financed retirements doesn't mean that there aren't worries and concerns as well. What are some of the sources of stress for the retirees that responded to the Voices of Experience survey?
Specifically for women, is that they were going to run out of money. Hmm. And or be alone. And, part of that is because oftentimes they're out of the workforce. We read all the time about how women's wages are less than men, and they do live longer. So that is definitely one concern. And, an answer to that, to help with those concerns, again, during the planning process, is we really recommend that men and women, meet with a financial professional to help put that plan in place. Oftentimes when you sit down and you don't know what you don't know, and many times once you put a plan in place, things may not be as bad as you think. We see that all the time where someone comes in with a thought in mind that they can never retire, and after putting a plan in place, see that they can, in fact, do so. And again, I think that retirement income, making sure that you have some form of, not all of your retirement dollars, but at least those to meet your fixed expenses as a lifetime income stream. Many times, especially our constituents in the nonprofit, educational, healthcare, cultural, they received a paycheck for 20, 30, 40 years. So, once you go to retirement, and ready to retire and want to enjoy those next 20 or 30 or 40 years that you might live, you want to make sure you have that paycheck, and that's what a guaranteed lifetime income is. And we do think that that is, adds to their satisfaction.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And we have Graham in Fish Creek up. Hi, Graham.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am 21 right now, and I've got, maybe $15,000 in college debt by the time that I'm done. So, not a crazy amount, but definitely some. I hear all the time about how important it is to start saving early. And I just want to know what the argument is for starting to save for retirement versus paying off student loans or other debts right off the bat.
That's a great question, Graham. And I think, Kathy, that really gets to that idea of planning and as soon as you can start putting money away, but it, especially in those early years, once you're just out of school, there are a lot of demands on what might not be a very big income.
Right. So it's funny because tomorrow we're having this conversation about Gen Ys and members of my team and just that. How do we help you put that budget together so that once you start earning income, yes, you have to pay off your college debt. Putting a plan in place to help you, be able to pay that off. But I do think when you start working, one of the things that you want to do is take advantage of whether it's a 401k or a 403b. And, remember, when it comes out as a pre-tax, it's you're not seeing the impact on your take-home pay as much as the amount that you're contributing. So, again, I think it's, trying to find that balance because we do know that, younger people today are coming out with so much debt. So not every situation the same. It's going to be harder for some people than it's others. But the truth is, try to, look at how you could set aside money for both. Might not be easy, but it's definitely possible. And again, if you are working at an employer that offers you some type of match, you don't want to lose that. And one piece of advice is, wherever you are, because we also know you're probably not going to work for 20 or 30 years at the same company like many people have today, don't cash that out. Roll it over. If your plan permits you to keep it in the plan, keep it in the plan. Don't be tempted to cash in that money. Let it roll over and continue to work for you.
As we wrap up, Kathy, I liked some of the quotes that you had in the report, which, again, people can find on the Central Time Facebook page, a link to that Voices of Experience survey. Some of the bits of advice that the respondents shared was, one was expect a period of missing the activities and interaction with people at work. And that's actually something I had not thought about. And another was learn a musical instrument or get involved in hobbies to be ready for a change in lifestyle from an 8-to-5 job. So sounds like don't wait until that retirement party's gone and in the books. Start those hobbies now.
That's a really great point. So that transition, just like you're transitioning your financial situation, oftentimes people aren't retiring. It's more psychological. It's what you've done or who you were for X number of years. So great point. It's getting involved earlier so that transition is much easier.
Well, I have to say reading this survey has made me pretty excited about retirement, even though it's quite a ways down the road for me, but something to look forward to on the distant horizon.
Great. So make sure that you're saving.
Well, Kathy, thank you so much for spending the time with us today.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Kathy McCabe is a senior managing director at financial service provider TIAA. She joined us to talk about their latest Voices of Experience survey, which looks at attitudes about retirement. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time.